Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Our time is very limited, so I'm going to keep introductions to an absolute minimum. You can find the bios of all the speakers in your brochure. You can find a little introduction to this session also in your brochure. But just to set the scene, I would like to read out one sentence, a question, from that introduction. What roles and influence will China acquire as it slots more firmly into its place in the global political jigsaw? And what implications will this have for countries beyond its borders as they continue to interact with this fragile superpower? You'll now hear four short presentations. Then I'm going to ask the other speakers whether they wish to reflect a bit on what they have heard. And after that little discussion, we will throw the matter open to questions from the floor. And so we're going to begin with Mr. Stephen Harmer on my left. Harmer.
Good afternoon. About a year and a half ago, no, it must have been longer, the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States interviewed two policy officials from the Bush administration, actually, who had just written a book on China called An Awkward Embrace. These policy officials from the Republican administration had just got a perch at the American Enterprise Institute and were now essentially free to espouse the kind of thinking on U.S. policy. I'll begin with U.S. U.S. policy toward Asia, toward China. And they had two things. They came up with two, what they called key and enduring strategic objectives of the United States. And they're talking about enduring, meaning over administrations. I believe also they would apply to the current administration. Number one was preventing, quote, domination of Asia by a hostile power or coalition. Two, nurturing a prosperous, peaceful, and free Asia. Republican policy makers, I believe one of them at least was from who's a careerist at the Department of Defense, the Pentagon. And I think particularly number one reflected very deep thinking, unfortunately, in my opinion, that remains part of the U.S. government policy, which is to say, preventing the domination of Asia by a hostile power or coalition. Well, think about, let's put ourselves in China's position. If this is good for the, if this is a key objective for China, or for the United States, how about China? How about China also saying preventing domination of Asia by a hostile power or coalition? In fact, that represents the reality right now for China, that the Asia is in fact under the domination, military, in terms of military might, military power, of, if not a hostile, at least a potentially hostile power, and particularly a coalition, an alliance structure set up by the United States, obviously, after World War II and throughout the Cold War, and unfortunately even has been unchanged until now. In fact, not only unchanged, but never relented, never relaxed, even when the Cold War ended in 1990, in the late 80s, early 90s, by the time it came to negotiate a new arrangement, a security arrangement with Japan, Bill Clinton and Prime Minister Hashimoto sat down and simply said, we will make no changes in the force structure, in the alliance structure. And this was 1996, and remained essentially 100,000 U.S. troops, U.S. Military, active duty military personnel in the region, our bases, our 7th Fleet, located in Okinawa, etc., etc. Point is, this hugely dominant military force structure, power, forward deployment of military force has to be seen by China as at least potentially a threat. And if it takes any more imagination than that, we can look at three other incidences. One would be that when Taiwan was threatening the Minjingdang, Democratic People Progressive Party was instead threatening to declare independence. China launched some missiles into the Taiwan Strait. Remember that? I think it was 1996, maybe it was. And Bill Clinton dispatched two U.S. carriers, one of which, incidentally, was called the U.S. Independence, to the region to demonstrate U.S. at least some sort of commitment to involve the United States in what really is a vital Chinese interest. Second would be the continued surveillance flights of U.S. Intelligence gathering aircraft, submarines, etc., around China's borders, on the coast, in the airspace, part of the reason for the air defense identification zone, continue, maybe even are being increased. Then we have Edward Snowden advising us last year that in providing documents showing that in the year 2011, the U.S. intelligence services launched 231 offensive cyber operations against targets including China, also including Iran, Russia, and North Korea. And we're talking about covert implants of malware that go into the computer systems, and we presume these would be in the defense apparatus and systems of China, sitting there undetectable, waiting to be turned on, in which case they eat up everything and completely degrade, disrupt, deny, destroy the capability of the systems. This is not intelligence gathering. This is offensive actions. So I don't think that China is unjustified in thinking that they've got a potential threat. The question is, why is this in the United States' interest? And my answer is, it's not in the United States' interest. The United States' interest, and in China's interest, is to develop a so-called, as Wang Yi or a Chinese official would say, non-conflict, non-confrontation, win-win. I mean, the Sunnyland Summit, Xi Jinping, the new great power relationship model or concept, non-confrontational, non-conflict, win-win relationship. There are no fundamental, real, vital interest conflicts between the United States and China. Why can't we come up with a relationship that accommodates that reality? And unfortunately, I think the reason is that we've got such deep structural vested bureaucratic interests, mainly on the U.S. side, in this alliance system, in this particularly the U.S.-Japan alliance, that simply are so antithetical and counterproductive in terms of coming up with a modus vivendi that's win-win with China. So it's really, I have to say, I'm extremely frustrated by all of this. Yesterday, Secretary Kerry met with Kishida, the Japanese foreign ministry, and again, it was the statement that the U.S.-Japan alliance is our cornerstone of U.S. security in Asia. Why? The U.S. security in Asia, our vital interests, our interests are in having a productive and constructive relationship with China. And this this alliance system, particularly which of which the core is true, is Japan and all the bases, is simply not compatible with that kind of framework. So I think during the first administration, the first Obama administration, under Hillary Clinton, who had... I'm over?
Up to ten. Oh. 1 minute. I'm just counting him down.
Oh, I'm sorry.
1 minute.
Under Hillary Clinton, unfortunately, I think we had just to put it very bluntly, an anti-Chinese attitude, almost emotional. Chinese didn't like Hillary, and Hillary returned the sentiment. For they say that Hillary was really quite favored toward Vietnam. Maybe that was part of the South China Sea sort of decision to basically stand up with the Philippines and Vietnam in territorial disputes with China. But the point is, it's not really turning out right. I think our interests are, we're not, U.S. policy is wrong. U.S. policy on the wrong track. The pivot is simply compounding the problem. The pivot is not just unnecessary, it is counterproductive. It should be reversed. As Chang Wanquan, Chinese Minister of Defense, said when he met with Hagel in Washington, you know, you're already unbalanced. What are you rebalancing to? What rebalancing? Rebalancing, pivoting to increase the imbalance. What are we accomplishing here? He also mentioned, why are you trying to weaken us? And that's, I'm sure, he was talking about the Snowden cyber attacks. So it's really not going very well. China, I believe, is doing its best to be responsible and is not attempting or seeking or has no ambition to dominate the region any more than is appropriate in terms of its size and importance for economically, as well as you might say just culturally. But this legacy of the U.S. Alliance system, Cold War, I think, to put it down, the overwhelming influence in Washington of the Pentagon in Asian policy is simply the reason for the problem. Hopefully, then it will change as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll turn straight to Professor Shu.
Oh, I thought you were the second Mac.
No. I got lost.
Thank you very much for bringing me here, a very rich foundation, and bring me all the way to here and speak for 8 minutes.
10 if you like.
My assignment is to speak on United States and China, but this subject is certainly everybody's an expert on this subject, so I think I may shift a little bit into making fool of myself by telling you what the Sino-American relationship are, since all of you must have known something about it. I decide to say something about why China and United States cannot communicate. From a cultural interpretation point of view. Most of the time, when I talk about culture, people immediately think I must be an apologist. I try to cover up for China by giving it a different cultural reading and providing different meanings into Chinese foreign policy. So be it, if you think that's an apologist statement. I think there's something going on between China and United States that will never really appreciated by either side. This has to do with the mode of thinking, this the epistemological assumption of both sides. I think the United States is always thinking in a multilateral terms, always thinking rules of United States, rules of international societies, looking for rules that can be universally applied. But Chinese tend to think in a bilateral way, in a relationship way. So going through negotiation with specific partners or neighbors along the borders in order to stabilize relationship along the borders. to the extent that when weaker parties or powers along the Chinese borders are forced to choose sides because of the confrontation between the United States and China, they don't have to choose sides if a relationship with China can be stabilized in a longer term. And actually, if a stable relationship can be achieved between China and Myanmar or Vietnam or any other smaller, weaker parties, then even though there is the pressure for them to choose sides, China would perhaps even smoothen the situation for their neighbors, because stabilized relationship with China would take them off hook. So even though there is a containment policy from the United States, for example, even though there is all kinds of treaties or allies set up between the United States and all those neighbors along the Chinese borders, there will be no threat to China, because relationship between China and neighbors can remain stable. If that's the goal, then that would be this kind of stabilized relationship between China and its neighbor would itself be a threat to the United States. For the United States, the existence of difference would be a threat, because that would block a universal rule from applying. For China, difference in power, the rise of another power, or the existence of different value does not pose any threat. What would pose a threat to China is the destabilizing relationship. If negotiation going on between China and Vietnam could not continue on the historical understanding between two countries, that would be a threat to China. So the rise of power in Vietnam or the change of regime in Myanmar would not be a threat to China. But all this would consider to be perhaps a value to the United States if the United States can coerce Vietnam into certain agreement on its relationship with China. Or the United States can facilitate some regime change in Myanmar that they probably would think that's a good a way to contain Chinese rising. On the other hand, if China doesn't take this as a threat, wouldn't that be strange and weird and perhaps more threatening epistemologically? Because something that's supposed to threaten you doesn't pose a threat to you. Would that make you very weird? But then on the other hand, if you consider, if China on the other hand consider all those universal rules apply to the other parts of the world from the United States, a way to transform or to destroy a stabilized relationship, that would become a threat to China. And I think that's something really hard to talk about, not just between China and the United States at official level, because even at the academic level, when we talk about this, people would immediately suspect you're promoting the legitimacy of a model which is not democratic, which is not liberal. Then I think deeper. I realize there is something, we could go even deeper. I realize that the United States is thinking at a spatial level, trying to convert difference. Everything can be synchronized if you really invest power or resource into it. The Chinese is thinking things along the temporal dimension. So something going wrong in a specific country, it doesn't matter. Let's be patient. Whenever it becomes governable again, it doesn't matter whether it's Islam or Christian or socialism or liberalism, anything that can remain stable, anything can remain harmonious, let it go. So you don't really enforce specific rules. So people thinking along the temporal level, anything governable that go, that becomes cyclical. This cyclical historiography is dramatically different from the spatial thinking. I think that's the deeper, perhaps a deeper foundation of the difference between the two countries. Let me stop here. I think the chair is already moving.
Thank you very much. Mr. Callum.
Okay. I have some pictures, some of which are pretty. First is, this is my book. It's for sale in bookstores, so make sure you copy down the title. Thank you. I'll quickly go to the next slide. So a lot of people are asking, where is China going? And the picture on the left is a book cover from China published by the Foreign Languages Press, which shows that it's not just outsiders in Europe and the United States who are wondering what direction China's going, where it's going. It's actually Chinese people thinking about it too. And then here's another thing. This is China passing Japan and the U.S. towards its ultimate goal. So there's a lot of talk about where China's going and what path it's going in. And Xi Jinping gave an answer about a year and a quarter ago. He gave us one answer of where China's going. Soon after he was appointed as the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, he told a television audience that his China dream is for the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. And he later explained that to fulfill the China dream of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, we must achieve a rich and powerful country, the revitalization of the nation, and the people's happiness. And so the China dream is a slogan. We talked about it yesterday at a panel. And it's very kind of, people are uneasy about how to treat it. Is it just propaganda? Should we discard it? But I think that slogans are very meaningful in China. And this picture on the right here is of Ai Qing, Ai Weiwei's father, the great poet. And in a poem that was written for Chairman Mao in 1941, he ended the poem by saying, "The new slogan determines the new political direction." So I think that's a very important way of thinking about these slogans, the China Dream especially. And so the China Dream means lots of things. It's mostly a domestic thing. So this is it's about a positive thing about how Chinese people can be prosperous and happy. So this is a picture of a TV show last summer from Shanghai Dragon TV about the Chinese idol. So that if you can't read in Chinese, the way the Chinese title is "The Voice of the China Dreams." This is kind of this interpretive or kind of populist view of the China Dream, which is very important right now. But my argument, I guess, today is that it's not just about domestic politics, not just about people's happiness. It's also about China's role in the world. And let's see. And it's a particular role in the world. We go back to the place that Xi Jinping announced his China Dream. It was at the National History Museum at the end of the Road to Rejuvenation exhibit. And Xi said that he learned deep historical lessons from this exhibit. And if you've been to the exhibit, you know it's not the kind of Chinese civilization. It's not 5,000 years of glorious civilization. No, that's on the other side of the building. This is about modern history. And it's the history of national humiliation, which is a very strong patriotic education program that has been working since about 1990. And it's to read China into global history as a victim, that China was victimized by imperialism, starting with the Opium War in 1840 and continuing with other Western powers and then Japan. And it's the sort of patriotic education that forms a certain kind of Chinese national identity. So I guess what I'm suggesting is because Xi Jinping did this with the Politburo Standing Committee there, it's very important that this informs his view of the China Dream. It's not just this wonderful future, but it's also rejuvenating from a horrible past, which is part of this global history of China as a victim. So I say that he rejuvenates not only Chinese nationalism, but this sort of pessimist nationalism, this victimized nationalism that has been popular in the past 20 years in China. So I suggest that the China Dream is not just a positive kind of singing contest, prosperity dream, but it's a negative dream, sort of negative soft power that's criticizing the West and criticizing Japan. It's really the source of that way of thinking of Chinese identity. Okay, let's get rid of them. So there are lots of descriptions in China about the China Dream. They actually talk about a world dream, that this notion of a world dream, or Shijiemeng, came up about 9 months ago after Xi Jinping talked at the National People's Congress. And it's talked about by various... I think we have a slide. There we are. The former ambassador to the UK said that China's dream is the world's dream, and then Xi Jinping said similar things to various foreign audiences, especially in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And what I found is reading that the media in China and some of the academic journals, that public intellectuals have really sees this notion of China dream and world dream as a way of talking about China's role in the world. And often it's a post-Western dream. So Hu Hongang has been talking about it for a while. He's a development economist, but heads a very important think tank in Beijing. So he predicts a great reversal of world order where the global South replaces the West. And so this is part of his notion of socialism, socialist modernization, international socialism. But he's also talking about China's traditional values. So he's one of these new left people who was fascinated not just by socialism, but by Chinese tradition and Confucianism and a more hierarchical way of understanding things. And this comes out in his writings because he says that the world dream for the 21st century is for the Taiping Tianxia, the great peace of all under heaven, and also this Shijie Datong, the kind of world of great harmony. Now, these are very kind of popular slogans and idioms in China, and they're not necessarily tell us much more, but the way he uses them is very political in the sense that he's trying to sketch out a Sinocentric world order. And I guess if you saw my video yesterday, you saw that one of the professors in Beijing, Yan Xuetong, he told me that national rejuvenation refers to those periods when China was very strong, like in the Han Dynasty, the Tang Dynasty, and the early part of the Qing Dynasty. And I asked him, well, you know, some people say this is imperialism. Tell me if that's wrong. And he said, no, it is imperialism. This is the imperialist system. And then he said, we can adjust it. We can learn from the positive part of it and develop a new modern international system. So what I find really interesting is this combination of socialist internationalism and this Confucian universalism. It may sound far-fetched, but I think that it fits in with how Xi Jinping is talking about regional foreign policy or periphery foreign policy. He gave a very important speech at the Diplomacy Work Forum last October, where he's talking about peripheral diplomacy, and on the one hand, it was very much about soft power, about deepening economic engagement with Southeast Asia, building infrastructure. But it was also about hard power that he wanted. He said that they'd have to have more joint military exercises with China's neighbors. But he also went into this sort of normative soft power about how China has to develop common norms and ideals and the notion of a common destiny. And what he was more or less saying is that Beijing needs to socialize its neighbors, socialize the region into this notion of a common destiny where China is the center, the gravitational center of East Asia. So along with this and other speeches, it seems clear to me that leaders in Beijing see China's rejuvenation, the China dream, as this moral mission to improve the world by spreading its ideas, aspirations, and norms. How much time do I have?
8 minutes. You've done 8 minutes.
I've done 8 minutes.
Two minutes.
I guess what I would... Do I have another slide? I do. So you can ask, is this successful? This is what happens when you take these sort of official statements in China seriously. I like to read propaganda. I really enjoy it. It's fun. And it has a certain rhythm to it after a while. But then you have to wonder, how successful is it? And I think that within China, the China dream, as we saw yesterday, is very successful. It speaks to a lot of people. This notion of a world dream is also very successful in China. But I find that outside China, it's not so successful. But if you read the Chinese sources, they'll say that the world is accepting the China dream and the world dream, and that some world leaders are using these ideas in their conversations with Beijing. So they point to the South Korean president when she went to Beijing last July. She told people that the China dream and the Korean dream have to work together for a Northeast Asia dream of peace. So people in China look at this and they say it's part of China's growing discursive power. But I found that after reading a lot of these speeches and media reports, that this acceptance or this interest outside China in the China dream is actually quite shallow. That, for example, IMF President Lagarde, used the Asian dream to frame her remarks at the Boao Forum for Asia last April. So this was seen as, again, that she's using the China dream and it's part of China's discursive power. But if you look at her speech, she only mentions it in the beginning and at the end. And that's just sort of to kind of recognize her audience. Otherwise, she just uses a standard IMF language. She didn't change her speech at all. So I guess I have three lines left. Is that okay? Okay. My sense is that this is quite interesting, is that in China, these ideas are very popular, very powerful. They think they're powerful outside China. They're actually not that powerful outside China. And this is part of the sort of tensions that I think are really interesting between what people in Beijing and in China think should be happening in the world and then what's actually happening in the world. I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Callahan. What I'm going to say is that it takes a slightly different tack. I thought I'm the last speaker, and I would speak, in fact, about something which has been raised in passing by Professor Callahan, and that is China and soft power. And it's a few reflections, a little assessment of China's soft power. Now, we don't have time for elaborate definitions, but I would use it meaning the totality of a country's impact on the outside world, or, put the other way round, the totality of the outside world's perception of a country, deriving from, not from, the hardware, not from military equipment, not from technology, not from conventional diplomacy. I think it's a question, is soft power really the business of governments at all? Well, perhaps predictably, the Chinese Communist Party think that it is. The Central Committee in October 2011 held a session on culture, and one of their conclusions was that it is a pressing task to increase the state's cultural soft power. President Hu Jintao referred to something called cultural security in a context where, as he put it, international hostile forces, I guess that's us, are intensifying the strategic plots to westernize and divide us. But I would argue that soft power goes a lot wider than anything that can be influenced directly by the agency of governments, really in two directions. One is the non-state sector generates soft power, whether you're thinking of individual creation, individual creativity, or the operations of private companies. And the other factor, which I think is important, is that soft power derives from the perceptions of the country from outside, how it organizes itself internally, how it treats its citizens, how it relates to the international community. So against that, how is China doing? And I'm just going to go through a few of the headings to give you some food for thought. Clearly, there has recently been a huge allocation of state resources in pursuit of soft power. So we see investment in the international media, expansion of Xinhua, CCTV, broadcasting in six languages, studios in the States, studios in Africa. But my sense is that it's a challenge. It's a challenge for anyone to grab attention in a media-saturated world. There's a need to match the competition in terms of attractiveness of presentation and in terms of an appearance of objectiveness and a lack of bias. And there I think there's still progress that China has made, but still some way to go. Second heading, education. And here I think the big success story is Confucius Institutes. Over 300 of them in the world, one here in LSE. And I think they have done a lot to bring Chinese culture, Chinese language to a new audience. There were suspicions that an organization so close to the Chinese government could be used to intervene elsewhere in a university's attitudes towards China. But all the evidence of which I'm aware is that the Confucius Institutes have stuck very successfully to their cultural mission. Next heading, public diplomacy. And all diplomats, and that included me, had to adjust to a new world where you address a broad public audience and you're operating in a very diversified, informal media environment. And my sense here is that China's diplomats have learned very fast. And you see now Chinese ambassadors who are excellent communicators in this new environment. They have loosened up, they have dropped the slogans, they have found the sound bites. They're very impressive. Then if you move on towards culture, this is an area where governments can exercise less direct control. China's cultural heritage will always be a very positive message, and it's used very successfully. But I think Peking opera and acrobatics will only take China so far. And the handling of contemporary culture is something where China's touch is less certain. I find it slightly ironic that the area which is clearly a huge success and I think has done a hugely positive thing for China's image is contemporary art, an area highly commercialized where government input has been minimal. Other arts perhaps are more problematic. A Chinese film made a big impact in the 1990s, but the directors from that time have gone back to safer areas. They design Olympic ceremonies instead. And China's new producers, they tangle with censorship. Some of the films that do get to the West can never be shown in China. And so I think it's right to say that a Western audience, they see one historical epic, they don't want to see another, and they don't find very much in the Chinese film industry that speaks about modern China and its problems. And finally, most problematic, does China's mode of governance and does China's international behaviour enhance its soft power? There was once a talk of a Beijing consensus, the idea that there was going to be a new model deriving from Beijing, a new model of international relations, a new model of development. But that talk seems to have died away. I think it is true that China has much to say which is of interest about new modes of interstate relationship in the modern era. But I think there are very few countries around the world that think of adopting the full domestic package, if you like, guided capitalism, single-party dictatorship, strict social control. No great resonance, I think, in the rest of the world. And I would say, without judging in any way, that from a soft power projection point of view, there are some areas where China's governmental action does undercut its appeal from that point of view. There are areas where the perceived requirements of security take priority. If you like, the Ministry of Public Security is strong, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is weak. So the handling of Liu Xiaobo, the Nobel Prize, whatever you think of the issues, I think from a soft power projection point of view, it was a disaster. Tibet policy, policy towards the Dalai Lama, from that point of view, is a disaster. Attitudes towards the Falun Gong, who I find a very creepy organization, nonetheless, it doesn't do China's image very much good. And I think you have to say, if you look at China's neighbours, that the way in which China is now tackling some of the disputes with its neighbours, whether in the East China Sea or in the South China Sea, they engender feelings of anxiety, feelings of apprehension, rather than feelings of friendship and admiration. So my conclusion, and I'm trying to be very objective about it, is that for all China's growing hard power, there remains a soft power deficit. And something is being done to overcome it, some successes are being chalked up, but it remains for China an uphill task. Thank you very much.
You didn't time yourself.
I didn't time myself, but I think I'm okay. Now, perhaps we might... I'm going to now recede a little bit into the background, but I'd like to ask the other speakers whether there are points that they would like to take up from what we have heard so far, points to which they would like to respond. I was very struck, for example, by Professor Xu and the way he characterized China's relationships with the countries of Southeast Asia. I don't know whether that's something, for example, which anyone else would like to take up.
Maybe I can ask you a question.
Yeah.
About soft power.
Yeah.
I think when we talk about soft power, we're not talking about just liking me, right? Because for United States, the soft power is that you don't like me, but then you still live my way of life.
Yeah.
But the Chinese understanding of soft power is to make people like China. That's a loss of soft power, right?
Love China.
Like or love. Yeah. But that's a loss of soft power, because that would force China to satisfy others and allow other people to intervene in Chinese way of life. So they have to use American dream as become a Chinese dream. They kind of mimic other people's discourse, creating misunderstanding, and they place China in a corner. So I'm thinking that actually the use of soft power, the term of soft power, understood by the Chinese, reflect the loss of soft power.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting way to put it. And I think if you look at the United States, very interestingly, I think the United States' soft power is immense. And it comes from two things. One is the perception of the United States, despite everything, as a place of opportunity and freedom. And the other one is, of course, the power of the US entertainment industry. What we think of that output, I don't know, but it's popular everywhere, including in Beijing. But, and that seems to outweigh all the negative perceptions of the Americans' international behavior. So if you kind of draw up a balance, it still remains, I think, very strongly positive.
I was supposed to talk about Japan, so I will weigh in here on Japan and the soft power issue. It's amazing, I think, to just consider that the extent of interdependence of China and Japan, and the cultural and historical sort of interaction and legacy and sort of debt paid mostly by the Japanese to the Chinese for their writing system, for Confucianism, for so much that is part of Japanese culture. But, in fact, as anybody who spent a lot of time in both China and Japan will know, they are extremely different. As a matter of fact, you might call it a clash of civilizations. I call it a clash of civilizations. And I should say, Samuel Huntington, when he was describing the various clashes of civilization, he made a very perceptive point of calling Japan's civilization different from the Sinitic civilization. So he classified Japan and China as being very different, and that is correct. Why can't they? And it's worse because Japan, with its declining population and sort of relative power, hard power or economic power, needs China. Certainly, I would say China needs Japan, but Japan needs China more. And yet, the surveys of how they regard each other show that. It's crude to say it, but the Chinese hate the Japanese. There's so much propaganda, again, anti-Japanese propaganda, part of this narrative, this campaign of even the sort of China dream, and vice versa. The Japanese don't like the Chinese either. So it's a soft power Cold War waged by, on the Japanese side, companies largely. There's some government interaction, but of course Japanese products are appreciated everywhere. And Japanese culture, pop culture, J-pop, etc., is appreciated much more than the Chinese will admit. I don't know what to say about it particularly, except that it's really extremely unhealthy and sad. It's tragic because the two societies have so much to offer each other, complementarity, and I mean the Japanese culture, if you don't know it, is spectacular. The civilization, I should say, it's not just it is a clash of two civilizations. I wish they would do better in communicating.
Can I follow up a little?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the ways that I, because I'm also interested in soft power, and who is that? One of the things I studied to look at soft power is gardens. So in the 20th century, turn of the 20th century, one of the ways that both Japan and China tried to show Europe and America that they were civilized was by building a Japanese garden in Chicago for the World Expo in 1893, and building one in Britain, I think, about 10 years later. And China did the same thing. So it's about, again, civilization, wonderful culture, we're not a threat, we're not barbaric, we're equal or better than you. And now we have Japanese gardens and Chinese gardens all over the world, and it's really great, and I like to go visit them. They're all over the world except in each other's country. There's no Chinese garden in Japan that I've been able to find. Chinese people would say that they're all Chinese gardens, but that's part of the problem. We discussed this in one of my classes this week, but where one of my students said, oh, the Chinese are ungrateful. They're ungrateful students of China. And it's like, yeah, that's not really a good way of thinking of it. But on the other hand, there's no Japanese garden in China, except in the World Theme Park, which, so that's Japan, is this Japanese garden, which became a famous film by, who did that, Jia Zhangke, in 2005. So I think that's really interesting that both countries have spread their culture, a very nice culture, through gardens around the world, except to each other.
No, right. If there are no other points from this end, then perhaps we should open matters up, and we will take questions. Yes, gentlemen, at the very back, right. Would you like to identify yourself so we know roughly who you are?
And my question would be regarding Professor Shi. And you just mentioned about China-US relationship, about maybe potentially those weak powers like Vietnam, Philippines will choose which side, or China or US. But personally, I'm more interested about Taiwan's position. if there is a military conflict between China, U.S. or Japan, which side would choose? Yeah. And another issue is regarding Stephen. I think for most of the Chinese people, the reason why most of the Chinese people hate Japan is partly because the political leaders never apologize officially to their crimes during the Second World War. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, first.
This actually happened in history. During World War II, a lot of Taiwanese intellectuals puzzling over which side they should choose. There's one creative solution raised by an intellectual named Cai Peihua, who decided to declare that he is the son of East Asia, using the Japanese term of co-prosperity, East Asian sphere. Hopefully he could persuade two sides to come to a peaceful solution. But then he was immediately caught, arrested by the Japanese military for potentially destroying the fighting morale of Japanese troops. But you could see the difficulty there, the dilemma. One is like a mother, the other is like stepmother, or one is like mother, the other is like father. If everybody belongs to East Asia, then there will be no fighting. Then Taiwan did not have to choose. If you guys are going to fight, then it's impossible for Taiwan.
Are you suggesting that families don't fight?
So are you suggesting sons are happy with family fight?
Okay, Steve, do you want to take up the Japanese?
Yes.
It is, I
hate to say this, but it is absolutely not true that the Japanese have not apologized for World War II, for aggression in China. They have done so many times. I guess it's never enough. And they are really kind of tired of apologizing. And then now we have Abe, who is not only tired, he really wants to, frankly, he feels that the time for apologizing has passed and we need to move on. I know that that doesn't resonate in China, quite the opposite. So it's a problem. I mean, the Japanese perceive that they've done enough apologizing, and from their perspective, they have. We know Murayama Sengen is one example, a previous prime minister. There have been many, including Tanaka, when meeting with Zhou Enlai in 1972 to normalize relations. Although he used the term meiwaku, which is in Japanese interpretation enough, but it just doesn't sound good when it's you look at the kanji, look at the Chinese characters. It doesn't mean the same. It doesn't have the depth of meaning that the Japanese give it. So that's the problem. It's really just it's so sorry. You know, you would hope that the Chinese government, frankly, would be helpful. Would try to use its influence, which is enormous, to assuage the resentment or the sense that the Japanese have not apologized, and not, in other words, not stir the fire, not keep turning the screw, but they do. It's not a positive thing. The Japanese are tired of it. They see it for what it is, and that's a problem. So I think the blame is at least as much on the Chinese side, if not more, frankly, at this stage. The Japanese, unfortunately, it's ridiculous. I mean, Wang Yi was interviewed. He raised the number of dead in China as a result of Japanese aggression. It's horrible. But the Japanese, needless to say, as they always would, as any people would, also remember the firebombings in Tokyo, the Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the rest of it. So they also think that they have a victim complex as well. So it's just, you know, again, the governments involved here have to decide to move on. The Senkaku Daoyu situation has made that impossible for the time being. I just hope it changes.
I heard you muttering on the Japan point.
No, he covered it. Yeah.
He covered it. You don't want to add anything.
No.
Okay, right. Well. Let's. The lady with glasses.
Sorry for my. This is a question to Professor Xi and the rest of the panel as well. So, Professor Xi, if I'm getting your points clear, I believe you're saying that it's difficult for China and the US to communicate on the issue of alliances because it's pretty much an ethnological problem where China and the US have completely different cultural domains and cultural logics where those international and political policies are yielded from. So would you also consider the international politics or international relation problems also to be an ethnological one? Also to be an ethnological one where different countries and powers have different normative framework, and if so, how do we solve the problem?
Well, I certainly don't have a solution, but I think it's always possible to develop a platform people can communicate, and then we have translators, interpreters all over the world. We need cultural translators, we need cultural interpreters to allow each side, in a way, if not sympathize, at least empathize with how the other sides come up with their idea, their perspectives. I think it is an epistemological problem. But I do see common feature between United States and China, that both are kind of a unilateral actor. They're both kind of a civilizing state trying to pose themselves as the model. But China as a model for people to learn voluntarily, United States is a model that go out to convert people. Then there's communication. But if you look at the two civilizing states, the problem is actually causing by their style, not necessarily by the contents of their ideas. Liberalism itself does not cause conflict. The way you spread or universalize liberalism, or the way you universalize Confucianism, that may cause conflict.
Okay, thank you. So empathy is also a key factor in international politics.
Empathy, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yes, please.
You're getting all the questions.
Mm-hmm. I'm Shan Wang from Geneva Association. I have a question. So in Europe, you know, the French and the Germans, they had war, but now they're all part of the European Union. Do you see in the near future there will be an East Asia Economic Union or some kind of a one market, because that's going to have a profound effect in terms of international relations. I'm interested in your views.
Mm-hmm. Who would like to take that on?
Can I just say, as the U.S. is pushing TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the initiatives going on in Asia are the China, Japan, Korea free trade agreement negotiations, much more supported, I believe, by, well, certainly, first of all, China is not being part of the TPP negotiations. Of course, they're much more concerned with the China, Japan, Korea negotiations. That would be very important if that's done. And then we have something called RCEP. RCEP, which is the Southeast Asian plus Australia, New Zealand, I guess it is, not including, though, the United States. So an ASEAN plus three framework, which China is also very much promoting in terms of a free trade, freer trade agreement, zone or sort of agreement. All of this is extremely positive. And I think it's inevitable, extremely positive, and let's hope it gets done. TPP doesn't have much, I think, to offer China, except perhaps as a fillip, a kind of incentive to work harder to get these other regional agreements done. And that's a very good thing.
When people who do European studies talk about the French and Germans, they talk about how integration and regionalization has worked, starting with economic kind of regionalism that spills over into political and cultural understanding. And it's about this building empathy through trading goods and trading people. What is curious is that people who talk about regionalism in East Asia and Southeast Asia often try to use this EU model, but they're always sort of stumped because there's been an enormous amount of integration in the Japanese and Chinese economies and in the Korean economies and lots of other Southeast Asian economies, but there hasn't been a spillover. People are still waiting for this so-called spillover effect. So that's why I just think that it's not enough to build up this empathy. There has to be, there's something more that's missing.
Hierarchy,
yes. Well, that's why you're gesturing towards me when you said Confucian universalism. But I don't see that. I guess to go back to my talk, something I didn't say is that Sure, China seems to be interested in building up this Sino-centric, maybe soft hierarchy in the region. I'm not sure that other countries are going to buy it. And they'll go along if they have to, but they won't be happy about it. And all this talk about history of tributary system, it just doesn't work outside China very well. It's just not popular. The notion of equality is quite embedded, at least at the state level, if not at the individual level.
I'd like to just follow that up, really, and ask Professor Xu if he'd like to say a little bit more in this connection about something he said earlier. And that is the idea of the US looking for a universal rules by which to regulate things, China thinking in a bilateral way. Now, Professor, you then went on to talk about China trying to stabilize individual relationships with the countries in Southeast Asia. But if you look at it from a slightly different point of view, as I understand the position, the countries of Southeast Asia want to do two things which are not bilateral, because they're very conscious of the disproportion between a very large China and a very small, relatively small Philippines. They want, firstly, multilateral negotiations involving ASEAN countries and China. China rejects it. They want some sort of international arbitration, United Nations, International Court of Justice, to take place, and China rejects that as well. So I don't quite see how that goes with your notion of China seeking to stabilize international relations, or is it more that China wants to establish these bilateral relations and use those as the only channel for this sort of discussion, simply because China is so much bigger and has so much power than the poor little Philippines, whatever, on the other side of the negotiating table?
Well, I think that's the standard realist explanation of Chinese bilateralism.
Yeah, well, I'm a realist.
That just
I'm sorry.
Is a bigger end. So I understand that, but I think there is something more to it that just why bilateralism is almost intuitively attractive to Chinese. Perhaps we have to read more Chinese literature to appreciate this kind of intuitive attraction. I think China is trying to do both multilateral and bilateral at the same time. Multilateral is more at the ritual level. And bilateral is where China could show either self-restraint or renounce self-restraint. Self-restraint is a way to show compromise and concession, and hopefully that the greater self will emerge and no one will threaten each other. And the renounce of self-restraint is to impose sanction on a policy which China perceives to be violation of previous understanding. So you will see bilateralism has no guarantee to be peaceful. It's like harmonious world has no guarantee to be harmonious. and harmonious world actually in history is never harmonious. Right? So harmonious world is a goal to be reached. But the process of reaching harmonious goal must involve both concession and the sanction. So it's not beautiful.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, please. White shirt.
Mayhem.
Thank you very much. I'm Bruce from the Arabian Monitor, and I would like to ask a question about China's relationship with the Middle East. And I would like to ask Professor Callan. We all know that China has increasing participation in the Middle East, given that the interim nuclear deal between Iran and P5+1 and Syrian conflict. Also, China has become the biggest oil importer of Saudi Arabia. So what do you think that China is going to, the role of China in the future in the Middle East, given that, given the increasing oil interest in the Middle East and a rising political power?
That's me. I really don't know anything about China's relations with the Middle East, so I think I should just not say anything. Sorry. You know more than I do, I think.
You know? Right. Does anyone feel qualified? Yeah. I think we're all going to pass on this question. I have a little note here telling me that that should have been the last question, but because it was a very short one, let's just take one more. Yeah, and please, yeah.
Thank you for the presentation again. I want to ask, I'm a student from Intro Coach. I want to ask Mr. Stephen Power. And you said China and Japan, basically they fight against each other because they have so many things in common and can share with each other. But is there a possibility that they fight, the government fight each other on purpose? That it's always good to have a, it's always good to have a common army, like people from north of China and from south of China. Like
they don't like each other until when we come to Japan. Yeah, when we're Chinese again. And do you think? So yeah, Chinese people from north and south, they don't like each other, but when they say when they talk about Japan, they're united again. Okay, thank you for asking me that question. It is unthinkable that Japan and China should have military conflict. It would be disastrous. And why should they, and what are they going to fight about? Senkaku, Daoyudao, Island? I mean, that's the only thing. That's the only conflict. No responsible leaders, even Abe, if you whatever you think of whether he's responsible or not, would be so crazy as to undertake. Of course, they talk about military conflict, go to war with China over that. But I guess we're talking about accidents. We're talking about inability to control escalation when from even small incidents. It's simply ridiculous. I mean, it's just completely unthinkable in terms of the interests of China or Japan to let that happen. I don't think that. I think there's no possibility. I certainly hope not. The war itself today, with modern weapons between a country like Japan and China, is unthinkable. Forget it. It doesn't make any sense. Which is also why this U.S. relationship, China-Japan alliance, is such a so unnecessary and counterproductive. It's simply driving an arms race that is in no one's interest, and not recognizing, frankly, the legitimate requirement of China, for example, to protect its sea lanes on their way to the Middle East to get that Saudi oil. So the military aspect is, it should be off the table, but the U.S.-Japan alliance, unfortunately, seems to put it back on the table. The ideal situation is that the U.S. abrogate that treaty, and Japan becomes a neutral country between China and the United States, very much in the model of. The author, the professor at the Australian National University, Hugh White, has described in a book called The China Choice, Why America Should Share Power.
Can I add something to that?
Yes, quickly.
Just a quick one. I think all the Japanese experts on China or sinologists that I have encountered or read, leaving one or passing ones, they all share one thing in common. Also, they debate on other things. That is, they all think about East Asia. They think about East Asia from two perspectives. One is whether Japan should take East Asia from the European or Western point of view, that making Japan part of West, or they should unite Asia so that make Japan the leader of Asia to resist white people or Europe or the West. But very few people in China that I have seen working on Japan talk about East Asia.
Right. And there I think we have to draw to a close.
Okay, I'd like to just I'd like to thank the distinguished panelists for a great discussion on China's international relations. Please give them a loud round of applause.